What's the best way to manage critically ill children?
What your doctor doesn't know about complementary and alternative medicine.
How about mindfulness meditation for low back pain?
And treating respiratory failure after abdominal surgery.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on March 25th, 2016, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, how about if we start with this issue in the New England Journal of Medicine? I served it up as, what's the best method for managing critically ill children? This is with regard to parenteral nutrition.
And it's important because oftentimes these critically ill children cannot be normally fed by mouth. And we know that nutritional deficiencies in this age group is associated with things like infections and weakness. If they're on a ventilator, it can prolong that time. It can delay their recovery. And we can't give enough food oftentimes to meet all their caloric needs. So we've given them intravenous nutrition. That's associated with some complications. So the real question is, when a child comes into the intensive care unit, should we start this intravenous or what's called parenteral nutrition early on, or should we delay giving it for about a week or so? And that was the source of this study. Now, if you ask me, I would say this study doesn't even need to be done because it's obvious that we need to start this nutrition early. But here's what they found out. They looked at over 1,400 critically ill children, half of whom were randomized to early IV parenteral nutrition. And the other half, they waited for 8 days. Now, by the way, they all had an NG tube placed, a nasogastric tube, and received a little bit of nutrition. But the interesting thing is the kids that received the delayed IV therapy, they actually had a better mortality. It lowered the mortality from about 19% to about 11%. The group also spent less days in the ICU, less days on a ventilator, and were less likely to have kidney problems as well. It flies in the face of what we thought, and it shows that in critically ill children, actually withholding the IV therapy for a week is superior to giving it early.
Truly a remarkable finding, goes to a lot of issues that we've talked about before. First of all, this idea that our a priori assumptions, when they're subjected to scrutiny, are frequently incorrect. The other thing is this issue of critical illness. We see this in adults as well as children, where we thought, wow, we see these spikes in glucose in adults who are in the ICU. We need to treat that. Oops, we found out that maybe we better not. The outcomes are better if we leave it alone. I think there's a lot of stuff about critical illness we really don't understand.
Yeah, and so giving evidence-based care, I think, is important. So I'm glad you picked this particular article. Speaking of critically ill things, you want to move on to the one that has to do with abdominal surgery?
Sure, that's in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
And I picked this particular one because I see patients in the hospital and many times they're in the intensive care unit, many of whom have had some type of abdominal surgery. And those individuals, during the surgery, they're on a mechanical ventilator and oftentimes in the intensive care unit, and then they're taking off the ventilator and we expect them to breathe on their own. Now, because of the abdominal surgery, sometimes it's difficult, especially if they've been on a ventilator for a long period of time. So many of these patients get re-intubated a second time. That's associated with a worse outcome, more infection. We'd like to prevent it. So these studies, two in particular, looked at two different possible ways of addressing this, both non-invasive. One is putting people on a non-invasive mask where it applies positive pressure. And that positive pressure is meant to kind of force air in. It improves the efficiency of breathing. The other technique is where people have a little cannula, that is little breathing tube on the nose, and there's oxygen pumped in. Both of these techniques were evaluated in people that have had an abdominal surgery and were at risk of being reintubated. Could these techniques prevent that? And what they showed, in essence, I'll just combine the results, in a large number of individuals in the intensive care unit, either of these techniques were successful in preventing reintubation. And in one of the studies, it showed it also decreased infection rates as well, decreased time in the intensive care unit. So this is an alternative way of keeping someone back off the ventilator.
Very desirable outcome, of course, because we know there's a ton of stuff associated with the ventilator, specifically pneumonia. Patients don't like it when they're coming out of that fog that frequently surrounds them. So these are all really good things. Here's one question I have. I've seen clinically when somebody is extubated and they're having trouble breathing, that's a pretty anxious time for them when they're trying to relearn essentially how to breathe. Anything in these studies or in your clinical experience that would inform that?
In fact, when someone has that difficulty, providing treatment can actually allay some of those fears because they feel like they're breathing better, they're getting more oxygen. Now, I thought you were going to ask me which of these two techniques is better, either the pressure or the high flow. In my experience, some people just don't tolerate the mask very well. And oftentimes, patients tolerate the high-flow nasal cannula better.
From here, then, why don't we move to two, what I'm going to call kind of alternative medicine strategies in the Journal of the American Medical Association, taking a look at a couple different techniques for helping patients manage lower back pain.
The incidence of back pain continues to increase. Regardless of treatments, people oftentimes have chronic low back pain, meaning it's lasted for more than 3 months. We'd like to do something that doesn't have side effects, may not be invasive, but could be effective. Cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, has been shown to be effective. That requires a licensed person, oftentimes a PhD or a psychologist, to administer that. There's a less intensive way called mind-body approaches. This involves yoga and meditation, having people not try to get rid of the pain, but deal with it in a way that's positive and can improve their function. So what these investigators did was they looked at over 340 adults between the ages of 20 to 70 years who had chronic low back pain, as little as 3 months to some as many as 50 years, and randomized them to the usual care, whatever the physician would normally do, to cognitive behavioral therapy, or to these mindfulness-based stress reduction, or these mind-body approaches. Both the CBT and mind-body approaches were administered over an 8-week period, usually for an hour or two per week. The mind-body approaches by somebody who been trained in that, the CBT by PhD psychologists, and they looked at 26 and 52 weeks to see did they feel better and were they more functional. They had to have a 30% improvement in their pain for that to be clinically significant. And what they discovered was that compared to usual care, either CBT or the mind-body approaches were similarly effective in making people more functional and in reducing their pain. Even though the therapy was applied for 8 weeks, the results lasted out to 52 weeks. That's pretty remarkable.
The thing I like, of course, about the mindfulness and yoga approach is that this is something that can be done at home. While it's possible to teach somebody the CBT techniques and clearly then they employ them themselves, the yoga and the mindfulness continue and could probably also, I would think, spill over into other areas of their life.
Absolutely. And the reason why they use it in low back pain is because it's been effective in other types of diseases also associated with pain. And you're right, this can be presented to someone self-administered or self-taught, these mind-body approaches. And in fact, in these particular patients, they were also sent home with educational materials and a CD instructing them how to do it properly.
Excellent. They could even give that to other people in their family. Everybody, get everybody on board. Finally, then, let's turn to a really interesting issue for this idea of, wow, people doing things themselves. I look at complementary and alternative medicines being employed by older folks, and oops, does anybody really hear about that when they intersect with the traditional or allopathic medical system?
I know it may not surprise you, but I'm sure it will many of our listeners, that 1/3 of U.S. adults report using some type of complementary and alternative medicine. These are things like herbs and supplements, massage or special diets, acupuncture, homeopathy. Oftentimes, physicians don't know about it. Given that individuals do use complementary and alternative medicines and have primary care physicians, how often do they disclose that to their physician? And when they don't, why not? So to address this, they looked at a 2012 survey, the National Health Interview Survey, that's been administered to over 100,000 individuals. A subset of that answered questions about complementary and alternative medicine. They had almost 7,500 individuals, and they asked them, did you disclose to your primary care physician that you were having some type of complementary and alternative medicine? 42% of patients surveyed said, no, we didn't. So then the next time they drilled down and said, well, why didn't you disclose it to your physician? 57% of the time they said the physician didn't even ask about it. And then 46% of the time they thought the physician didn't even need to know. Infrequently, it's because they were concerned about negative reactions from the physician. So this tells me as healthcare providers, we need to ask our patients about it because the patients don't think you need to know about it. And if you don't ask about it, they won't reveal it.
Are there any specifics on common interventions people choose that may negatively impact more traditional therapies?
Well, what I'd say is 75% of these people that were using complementary and alternative medicine were using herbs and or supplements. And we know these are oftentimes not regulated by the FDA. Oftentimes these herbs and supplements can either diminish or enhance the effects of certain medications. And as a result, they can sometimes increase the side effects associated with routinely prescribed medications as well. And that's why it's important for healthcare providers to ask and for the patients to realize it's important. So if your physician or nurse practitioner or PA doesn't ask, please volunteer that information.
Right. Part of the whole comprehensive electronic health record, for sure. On that note, I am going to talk about the mindfulness technique for low back pain this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.